With Viviane Gosselin, the curatorial lead for the Museum of Vancouver, on the Living with Long COVID exhibition, which is up until March 22nd, 2026. This has been Danny Nesvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM. This segment would not have been possible without the continued support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Local Journalism Initiative. You can also find this piece on frequencynews.ca.
You are listening to CJSF 90.1 FM. Broadcasting from Burnaby Mountain, British Columbia.
You're listening to CJSF Radio, Simon Fraser, 90.1 FM.
You are listening to CJSF 90.1 FM on your dial, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. And you are listening to Future Talk with your host, Dr. Paul Tenery, professional engineer, professional futurist, and sometimes occasional sessional instructor of future studies at Simon Fraser University. And this is a weekly show that looks at future trends and issues and important items that affect your daily life and will be affecting your life into the future. Welcome to the show. We're continuing our look at the book, The Mind of the CEO, which is looking at the future of the corporation. And this book is written by Jeffrey E. Garton. Last show, we were looking at the chapter, The Biggest Blind Spot. A serious problem is the sheer number of new and pressing issues that confront both governments and business executives these days, ranging from the possible effects of global warming to the implications of genetic engineering to the rise of international crime syndicates. All these will complicate the functioning of markets and raise near intractable questions about the rules of the game. What are these rules? Who makes them? How well do they work? Here we shall look at some of the pressures chief executives face in dealing with society at large. The next chapter explores some of the activities CEOs ought to contemplate above and beyond what they're already doing. Following that, we'll look at what American CEOs in particular should be thinking about and what they should be doing. Since the late 19th century in the United States, when the railroads and telegraph helped firms like Coca-Cola and Procter & Gamble to expand from coast to coast, the large corporation has been one of the defining institutions of society. In Germany, Japan, and elsewhere, companies like Deutsche Bank and Mitsubishi Corporation have played pivotal roles in their countries for over a century. In the three decades after World War II, large companies around the globe took on ever increasing social obligations. Using their large sizes, scales, and resources, they provided secure jobs and good wages and guaranteed pensions, not to mention generous support for economic development in their communities, including contributions for culture and charities. Leaders of these companies had almost unlimited discretion to set the goals and priorities of their organizations, as well as to allocate resources to objectives not directly relating to shareholder value. In the United States especially, where relatively limited government has always been the prevailing philosophy, large companies played a partnership role in the public sector. In fact, companies provided so many services at such a high level of security that a private welfare state was possible without the expansion of government power and expenditure. However, a lot has changed in this country and in others. Under the pressure of international competition, companies have increased their preoccupation with the bottom line. The implicit contract between management and labor, the two-way loyalty, has disappeared. In the United States, is in the process of substantially loosening up in Europe and Japan. The world has moved from managerial capitalism, where CEOs and their top management had the ability to allocate their company's profits with relative freedom, to what may be called investor capitalism, where shareholders exercise substantial control over how corporations distribute their profits. In today's new economy, governments are being pared down, market-oriented policies are gaining ground, and the norms for CEOs and their companies are changing. Where is the balance between private and public interests? And is that the right place? What do CEOs think the responsibility should be when it comes to labor, when it comes to education, and when it comes to the environment? What do CEOs want their roles to be in developing global rules and institutions to guide society in this new century? These are potentially explosive questions. Although any society wants some agreed sharing of roles among businesses, government, and citizens, the balance of power and influence among these groups is in great flux in all countries today. The uncertainties are compounded in the global arena, where there are not only a few rules but vast disparities in wealth and expectations between people and the different histories of different cultures and economic and political systems. Quote, there is a worldwide effort to find the right balance between business and government, unquote, said Franklin Rains, formerly the director of the Office of Management and Budget in the Clinton administration, and now chairman and CEO of Fannie Mae, the world's largest financial institution devoted to housing finance. And through much of this century, we haven't gotten the balance right around the world. While spending an enormous amount of time trying to figure out how to divide up the pie, we didn't grow the pie as much as it could have grown. Therefore, we're having these intense battles. Rainey's also put his finger on an endemic problem everywhere. Quote, deep down in a lot of people in government, there's a sort of confiscatory urge. They will convince private capital to come in, and then they'll grab it and go back to command and control. There's a tough issue here. How does government encourage markets, encourage private capital, but not get into micromanagement in a way that ultimately drives away all the private capital? CEOs face a number of constraints in dealing with their part in this balance. For understandable competitive reasons, they are reluctant to engage in activities that do not contribute to their company's profitability. They have little time to spare for anything else. Whatever broader role they are called upon to play, they fear that they can never do enough. For the more expansive their efforts, the higher the expectations are raised. In other words, they worry about being held accountable for commitments they cannot deliver. Even so, virtually all CEOs recognize the obligation to be leaders in civil society. Most CEOs believe that they are socially responsible. They emphasize the importance of helping whenever they can, of shaping the environment, of knowing what works in practice, and of the needs to contribute their expertise to global problems. John Brown of BP, Mark Moody Stewart of Royal Dutch Shell, William Ford, and others talk about the strides that they are making on environmental issues, settling internal targets for emissions, publicizing these goals, submitting to outside audits, all of these being measures that are revolutionary compared to corporate behavior just a few years ago. American CEOs, in particular, point to China as an example of progress they are bringing to emerging markets. Honeywell's Michael Bonsignori is proud of what his company has done in China. Elected chairman of the U.S.-China Business Council in 1999, Bonsignori leads a company that entered China in 1986 and has since provided a range of on-site services ranging from the installation of safety controls in Chinese mines to providing technology to improve air traffic control. Some of Honeywell's activities have involved strategic partnerships with companies like the National Petroleum Corporation. In August 2000, Honeywell set up its first dot-com outside the United States in conjunction with the Chinese Ministry of Construction. Tsinghua University and the Hong Kong Productivity Council, the objective was to offer information on the web on procurement in the construction industry, project leads, and online training for customers like the China State Construction, Shenzhen Design Company, and the Chinese Construction Third Engineering Bureau. Quote, I think that companies like ours have been and continue to be great role models as social reform is going on around the world, Bonsignori told me. They can help create the conditions which make economic prosperity easier rather than harder. They can show the way with regard to the best practices and highest standards for respecting the individual in the workplace. When I sit down with our Chinese employees, the one thing that comes through to me over and over is how proud they are to work for our firm because of our high standards, our integrity, and the good way we treat them, and the way we deal with customers. And I believe will have an influence on future generations of leaders. That's why I have been such a proponent of engagement with China, not because I'm less unhappy with them about nuclear proliferation or human rights or other things, but I just say to myself, quote, it's absolutely essential that we share some of our social values so that we begin to change how people think and behave. If you want to call that cultural imperialism, well, then so be it. Pepsi-Cola's Roger Enrico feels the same way. Pepsi was one of the first American companies to invest in China in the 1970s. It sells both soft drinks and snack foods, such as potato chips. It has competed with Coca-Cola and more recently with soft drink manufacturers for Chinese consumers. Its visibility in the Middle Kingdom was enhanced in 1999 when the company signed a 5-year contract to sponsor China's National Soccer League. Enrico has also been a vocal proponent of normalized trade with China. In fact, I first met him in 1998 at a meeting of the World Economic Forum in Singapore. He was chairing a panel, which I was a member, on why China should be allowed into the World Trade Organization. I asked him if I could argue against Beijing's entry, just to get a debate going. Enrico said he would be delighted to mediate the controversy that would ensue. In our interview, he said, a lot of people would argue, and I tend to agree with them, that running a successful company is the most important thing I could do, not just for the company, but also for the broader world. Take China, for example. The things we and other companies, such as American companies, do in this country are so far superior to what China has had in the past. There's more democracy in our company and among our employees there. There's open competition among our Chinese employees and PepsiCo employees around the world, which opens up horizons for Chinese workers and makes them see that they can be world class. They're bringing not just capital to China, but a modern operating mentality, which is invaluable to China's workforce. CEOs also understand some of the anxieties that are building up in developing countries as the global society threatens to overwhelm deeply rooted cultural values. Susan Beresford of the Ford Foundation articulated what is happening. Quote, "This is a period in which the pace and the depth and the extent of change in the world that we work in communities around the world, has been deeper than at any other time that most people can remember. The economies have changed. The political structures have changed. The ideologies have shifted. In periods of great uncertainty, people search for anchors, and some find the most comfortable anchors in things from the past. In many of the countries that we work in, including in the United States, where we used to be able to work with an assumed set of values, there now has to be a discussion and a search for the adaptation of traditional values to modern needs." She used as an example programs that try to connect human rights values, which seem to many to have emerged from the United States and Europe, to traditional religious beliefs of developing nations. Quote, "There is a need for people to find their own language and their own interpretation of what human rights may have meant in the evolution of their own cultures," she said. "Of course, there's always going to be people who think their interpretations of old values are the same old values, period. But they are not acknowledging at every time there was probably a variety of interpretations of every tradition, and it has tended to be one set of views that prevailed. But if you go back to the historical records and early writings, you often find that there were debates about these things, and people want to give a contemporary voice to them." She also talked about the Ford Foundation's efforts to promote folklore in India. Quote, "Not because folklore is some quaint thing that ought not to be washed away by McDonald's, but because people in that country are saying that the globalized culture, the kind of homogenized international culture that creeps in or sweeps across country after country, does not feel authentic to them. All these things connect with what I see as an enormous search for meaning and value of distinctiveness." Richard Thoman, then president and CEO of Xerox, saw similar pressures arising. Quote, "I think there is an interesting thing happening in Europe, and that's what I call the conflict between the economic and cultural agenda on the one hand and the political agenda on the other." He told me, quote, "Businesses are gaining an increasing global scale, but at the same time there is growth in most parts of Europe of a fairly localized phenomena around language, culture. For example, look at the Basques, the Scots, the Welsh. You see the differences that we have been submerged within a nation for hundreds of years, increasingly emerging. The problem is that you have an economic agenda that calls for bigger and bigger scale, and a political agenda which places value on catering to local drives. It's a potentially combustible issue. Deutsche Bank's Rolf Brewer expressed some of the same concerns. Quote, "To be frank, I see a renaissance of nationalism," he said. "Look at the Balkans, look at the Middle East, and look even at the European countries on the continent, and how they're all defending their finance industries. In fact, in my view, it is the nationalism and not globalism that is growing fastest." Jürgen Schripnip agrees, quote, "You will see a tremendous backlash in the 21st century," he told me. "Some CEOs are particularly sensitive about the inequality of wealth and income around the world and to the implications of these disparities. Quote, when you're thinking about free markets, the trend is our friend," said Roger Enrico. "But if that also means the government is not working so hard to balance the distribution of wealth, we do have to care about that. Because the fact of the matter is that we have a consumer-driven market. If there is a shrinking middle class, that's not a good thing. I worry that if current trends continue here and ahead, down the road to socialism or worse, this will again be an attractive alternative."
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. and you're listening to Future Talk with your host, Dr. Paul Tenneri. We're now going to take a short break and listen to a very important public service announcement.
Every year, countless people succumb to the temptation to purchase exotic animals like hedgehogs, lizards, monkeys, even tigers and bears to keep as pets. But life in captivity is often a death sentence for these animals, who may suffer from malnutrition, an improper environment, and the stress of confinement. For more information on this issue, visit the BCSPCA website at www.spca.bc.ca.
Welcome back. You're listening to CJSF, 90.1 FM, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. And you are listening to Future Talk with your host, Dr. Paul Tenneri, professional futurist.
Welcome back. We're looking at the book, The Mind of the CEO, by Jeffrey E. Garten, which is an examination of the future of the global corporation. We were looking at the biggest blind spot chapter. At the World Bank, James Wolfensohn ranged a host of related concerns. Quote, "The biggest challenge that the global community faces by far is population growth," he said. "We have just passed 6 billion people on the planet, and we will move to 8 billion within the next 25 to 30 years. The gap between rich and poor is increasing. These issues are not local anymore because the world is now linked by financial systems, by trade, environment, health, and immigration, and other factors. Technology could cut one of two ways," he said. "There is an opportunity for the developing world to fall behind another generation or catch up in a generation. The challenge is enormous because technology itself won't be enough. There must be organization. There must be coordination among development institutions. Today, for example, there's no real coordination on almost any subject. And if you get into the plethora of initiatives being taken with new technologies, it's not all brought together. You could have bedlam. On the other hand, if you can utilize technology to deliver information and knowledge to build capacity at all levels of government and in developing countries, judges, customs, officials, and so on, you're talking tens of thousands of people who could benefit. The potential here is just monumental. I asked every interviewee the question, quote, what keeps you awake at night? By far the largest number of responses reflected a fear of a major disruption, rarely precisely defined in the process of globalization. Henry Paulson, Jorma Olia, Rolf Brewer, Hiroshi Okuda, Rebecca Mark, and others all said that their entire business strategies were based on the assumption of continued momentum and global economic liberation. John Brown worried about adverse developments in the Middle East. U.S. executives such as Frederick Smith, Roger Enrico, and Michael Bonsignori, and Asian CEOs such as Stan Shi, Hiroshi Okuda, and Victor Feng were deeply concerned with the future of China generally and about the U.S.-China relationships in particular. While business leaders understand these issues, if you listen to what they say, and if you think about what they don't say, you can see that most of them are very careful to set limits on their political and social responsibilities. They are trying to balance a wide range of opportunities and risks, and in the end, there is little enthusiasm to undertake anything that goes beyond what they're actually doing. Their views are thoughtful and subtle, but most of them approach their obligations very gingerly and with more sense of constraint than possibility. Richard Thoman, for one, has been a proponent of CEO leadership on some of the bigger social questions. But he believes that chief executives will have to link their activities to specific firms rather than play a more general role in the making of national policy. Quote, "The smart CEO will recognize that part of his own success is in creating an environment where his companies and others get better results, he told me. But it has to be done more thoughtfully and deliberately than the old days. The old model is one in which the CEO spent a lot of time outside the company. But today's model, in which the CEO must deliver corporate performance, requires a more direct linkage to your own business." Thoman may have been reacting to the experience of working for James D. Robinson III, then chairman and CEO of American Express in the late 1980s. Robinson became a global business statesman to such an extent that he negated the running of Amex, and it fell on hard times. He became a leading figure in promoting trade negotiations, in opening Japanese markets, in restructuring third world debt after the Latin American financial crisis earlier in the decade. At the time, I worked for Lehman Brothers, which was then owned by Amex. The enormous time and energy Robinson poured into global affairs seemed excessive to me, even to someone like myself who applauded the intent, especially at the time when the company was losing ground to competitors. The clear lesson is one that we have heard before in this book. First, you have to be competitive and profitable. Without that, nothing else will work. Lawrence Weinbach of Unisys advocates staying close to home in another way. I proposed a hypothetical situation to him. Suppose, I said, a U.S. president asked you to bring Unisys into a program and help students in the inner cities to contribute money and people. What would your response be? My notion of social responsibility would really go to the communities in which we work, and therefore I believe that business has a responsibility to do what you're suggesting, he replied. I could choose those communities where we have people. I wouldn't pick Pittsburgh because we're not there, but I pick Philadelphia because we are there and we have people there. Mark Moody Stewart of Royal Dutch Shell is also careful when it comes to specific social responsibilities, even though his companies have gone to great lengths to be an environmental leader. Big companies ought to be willing to give their advice to governments, he said, but in the overall picture of who calls the shots is not as simple as it used to be. Quote, "In trying to achieve the balance between economic and social objectives," he explained, "it is really the whole of society, including customers, community activists, government, and their own employees, that will judge us and keep us in bounds. In other words, don't get too far in the front." In other words, don't be so far ahead of the parade that no one knows you're in it. We're going to be looking at this and other important points in this very interesting book, so please stay tuned.
You have been listening to Future Talk on CJSF 90.1 FM on your dial, 93.9 cable FM in Burnaby, and Future Talk is a weekly show on important issues that affect you and your future. And this is Dr. Teneri, professional futurist, reminding you that if you're not willing to make the effort to invent your own future, then others will be only too happy to invent it for you. See you next week.
listening to CJSF Radio Simon Fraser 90.1 FM.